So, we are back again with the Anapanasati Sutta, the discourse on the mindfulness of breathing. And I was just yesterday, we were just starting off, and we were talking about the preliminaries that you have to do to get established with mindfulness of breathing. And then we did the first four parts of this discourse. It has 16 parts altogether. And we did the first four parts. And the first four parts were you breathe in long and you are aware of that breath, of the length of the breath, and you understand that the breathing is short. And then you expand that attention to take in the whole breath, and then you actually allow the breath to calm down. And none of these activities have willpower in them. They're all natural things that happen as you watch the breath, the peacefulness, the calming down, the full awareness are natural occurrences that happen all by themselves. So when it says here that you train in this way, it doesn't mean that you are forcing these things. What it means is in part that you start to understand how these things come about. As you practice the mindfulness of breathing, you see that there are certain causes and conditions that cause the breath to become peaceful, that cause your awareness to expand. And as you, the more you practice, the more you start to understand how this whole process functions. And when you understand how the process functions, it's easier for you to put the causes and conditions into place for it to work also in the future. Sometimes people, when they read this, they think, oh, I should be aware of the long breath and the short breath. And they think that that means controlling the breath, controlling it to be long, controlling it to be short. But I think it's quite clear that it doesn't mean that at all. All it means is that you have a knowledge, an awareness of the breath, whether it's long and whether it's short. And that's why it says at the beginning, just mindful, just awareness, not control or anything else, but just awareness is what you have when you do this exercise. So this first part then is equivalent to the body contemplation of the Satipatthana Sutta. And the reason that is so, and it comes later down, is because the breath is considered to be like a body in Buddhism. It is a particular type of body in the sense that it is a collection of various types of breath, and the full collection of all the various types of breath together is the body of breath. And then the second aspect of Anapanasati, this is then equivalent to the Vedananupassana, the contemplation of feelings in the Satipatthana Sutta. And this is what's coming next. So what's happening here is that as you calm down, as the breath becomes more and more subtle, more and more peaceful, there comes a point when feelings start to arise, very pleasant types of feelings. And those are then the kind of, this is why the second part of Anapanasati is equated to Vedana, to the contemplation of feelings, because feelings start to arise at this particular point. So this is how it reads in the sutta. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing rapture. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing rapture. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing pleasure. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing pleasure. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the mental formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the mental formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the mental formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the mental formation. So this is all about experiencing feelings that come with the breath. So the first part here, experiencing rapture. Rapture is this word called piti in Pali. And it is both a mental and also a physical feeling. Rapture is something you feel in the body. And it's like this, it can be like this coursing, this kind of joy which sort of runs through the body. And it can be very, it's very pleasant experience for most people when this happens. It's a feeling of joy that goes through the body. It's a physical sensation. And it's also a sensation of the mind. But initially, this physical aspect of it is very strong. And if you read some of the commentarial works on Buddhism, like the Visuddhimagga, it gives you a long list of different ways in which this rapture can be experienced. And different people will experience it differently. Raptures which sort of go up and down the body, rapture which are more stable, and all these different types of rapture that you feel. But it is this pleasant feeling in the body that you're experiencing. This is what is meant here initially. And this comes when the breath starts to become peaceful. These things start to happen. And again, it's all by itself. So when you train in these things, it means that it happens by itself as a natural cause of the mind becoming peaceful, the breath becoming peaceful. And again, you train in this way, it means that you become aware why these things happen. What are the causes and conditions for these things to happen? And then in the future, you are more skilled in the meditation because you know the causes and conditions. And also, it means that you become more aware of the importance of things like virtue and morality, because you see that these things go in the opposite direction of doing kind of doing the wrong things in life, if you like. And the next one here, I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure. The word, Pali word here is sukha, and sukha is a more refined experience of happiness. It is deeper than the feeling of joy that comes before. And again, it comes because you're calming down even more. And the feeling of sukha, the feeling of pleasure, comes when the body starts to become very, very tranquil, very peaceful, to the point where the body starts to disappear absolutely and completely. You don't feel the body anymore at this stage. And this is one of the differences when you have piti. The piti is a physical sensation, but here you're moving towards the mental sensation instead. The piti is where everything becomes very, very peaceful and the body starts to fade away. The next one here is experiencing the mental formation. Well, the formation here is this word sankhara again, which usually in the suttas means like activity. It is the will and the volition. And the mental formation, the citta sankhara, is defined in the suttas as perception and feeling. Sanya and vedana is how it is actually defined. So what you are moving towards here, you're moving even more away from the physical things, and this is becoming more of a mental experience. That's why this is the mental perception and mental feeling that you're experiencing. The piti sukha, the rapture and the happiness becoming more refined, and this is a mental understanding of these things. This is how I understand these things. And I also consulted with Ajahn Brahm, because sometimes these things are not very, it's not absolutely clear what is meant here. But this is a very likely way of understanding this. And then comes the next step. You should breathe out, tranquilizing the mental formation. In other words, it's just like with the breath previously, at each stage of the meditation, you use a continuous tranquilization, continuing, making things more peaceful. And at this, while you have feelings in the mind, and while the breath is still there, there's still a certain amount of activity happening. So you're still tranquilizing things down till the activity almost stops completely. And this is what is happening at this stage. The feelings become more peaceful. The feelings become more refined. And in a sense, that refined happiness is much more powerful and much stronger than the coarser happiness you had beforehand. And because you are tranquilizing things here, there comes a point when the body and the breath and the coarse feelings disappear completely. And this is then where you move into the next stage, which is the experience of the mind, purely experience of the mind. But before I go on to that, just this then is the feeling aspect of satipatthana that you're doing here. And it's not so much that you're focusing on the feelings. You're still focusing on the breath. You don't allow yourself to get carried away by the feelings. Your attention is on the breath. But you're experiencing the feelings at the same time. So there's a kind of it's still a fairly broad awareness at this stage. Your mind is not yet fully one-pointed, so you can experience a number of things at the same time. And the feelings and the breath are there at the same time. But your main focus is still the breath. But you know that the feelings are there. So this is then the Vedana Nupassana. And as I was saying before, is that this is sufficient. This is all you have to do to fulfill the Vedana Nupassana. If you look at the Vedana Nupassana, the contemplation of feelings in the Satipatthana Sutta, it includes a large range of feelings. And this is like just a subset of that. But this is sufficient for you to actually go all the way to enlightenment. If you can do this much, then you are, that's enough. And then you move on to the next stage of Satipatthana, and now we go into the mind contemplation. This is called the Chitta Nupassana in the Satipatthana Sutta, contemplation of mind. And it reads as follows. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, gladdening the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, gladdening the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, concentrating or unifying the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, concentrating the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, liberating the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, liberating the mind. So here we are getting to the point where you are moving completely beyond the body, which means beyond the breath, and you have a pure mental experience. And this, it is not entirely clear. If you read the commentary, they say certain things about what this experience are like. But I think that what may very well be meant here, that this is a stage where you get these bright lights in the mind, sometimes called samadhi nimittas. In the suttas, they're just called a light or basa. And this is the stage where that, where the body has completely disappeared. All sense of the physical breath or whatever goes away, and you're left with a light in the mind. And this is an experience, a mental, purely mental experience, where you basically have gone beyond the body. And once you have that experience, that light can have take many different forms. It can be a light which is bright, it can be a light which is dim, whatever. But the idea is then to purify that light in the mind so it becomes brighter and brighter and brighter. And this is what is meant here by gladdening the mind. Because when you keep your focus, you keep your attention on this light, it becomes brighter and happier. And you are actually gladdening that experience as you go along here. So you're gladdening in it, and then you are also concentrating the mind. You're focusing more and more narrowly on this light. The light itself is becoming more and more still, more and more peaceful. And this is the unification of the mind, more and more one-pointed in your practice. And now we're talking about very deep stages of meditation here, very, very profound stuff. If you can get to have any experience like this, it is sure to be quite literally mind-blowing for you, because these are very, very profound things happening here. And then when the concentration, that unification of the mind reaches a certain point, there comes a point when you get this thing called liberation of mind, when you go beyond all kinds of possibility of sensory experience, where you go beyond the ability of the mind to experience sounds, etc., and all these kind of things, and the mind is liberated 100% from the hindrances and 100% from the five senses. And this is Vimochayang Chittang, the liberation of the mind, is related to the vimokas. The vimokas in the suttas are the liberations that come by the jhanas through the Brahma Viharas. Brahma Viharas are the loving kindness, the compassion, the equanimity meditation, and also even higher states than that. But this is equivalent to those vimokas. So here you're talking about entering very, very profound states of samadhi. And at this stage, you're getting very close to awakening, to seeing things as they actually are, because you have abandoned the hindrances, the things in the mind which blocks you from seeing things have basically been abandoned at this stage. So what this mindfulness of breathing shows you, it shows you a gradual descent into mind, into states that are more and more still, more and more peaceful, gradually, gradually, gradually. And there's a beautiful path, because almost this whole of this path is just full of wonderful experiences of peace, of tranquility, of happiness, of rapture, all these things. It's absolutely wonderful thing to do. So it's one of those journeys that are really, really worthwhile. And as you do that, you find yourself becoming more and more mindful, more and more presently aware, having less and less interest in the world around you, and you become very centered inside yourself. It's a wonderful thing to happen. And it's also a very selfless experience. You have less and less concern about yourself, and you don't really think in terms of yourself anymore so much. It becomes just beauty on its own, without the experience of an I within that beauty. And so then, once you come out of this, the last four steps here, this is equivalent to the citta nupassana, the contemplation of the mind in the Satipatthana Sutta, and that contemplation of the mind includes experiences such as these, experiences of the mind that is free from, that has all these kind of beautiful states in it. We can maybe look at the citta nupassana later on. And the citta nupassana also includes the experience of the jhanas. You have in there things like the mahagata citta, the mind gone great, and that's a synonym for the jhanas. You have, what else are the synonyms? You have the anuttara citta, the unsurpassed mind, which can also refer to deep states of meditation. So again, you can see that these things are actually there. Part of the citta nupassana is the understanding of these deep states of meditation. And then we come to the last stage of anapanasati, and this is where the insights truly start to happen. Now, it's important to understand that there is no real distinction in Buddhism between insight and samatha. Tranquilization and insight go together. And you will have one of the things I was pointing out before about overcoming defilements. You overcome defilements through wisdom. And that is part of insight. That wisdom that you give rise to abandon defilements of the mind, that is a weak form of insight, of vipassana, of seeing things clearly. Because when you see things clearly, you abandon those hindrances. And all the way along this path, as the mind becomes more peaceful, your vipassana is increasing. Vipassana is just clarity of the mind. It's clarity of seeing things straight, seeing things in the right way, seeing things according to reality. When you become peaceful, the hindrances are abandoned. You see things more clearly. And because you see things more clearly, you start to understand what gives rise to peace. And that is a very important part of this thing called vipassana. Once you understand that, it enables you to practice peace more in the future. So a sign, a very important sign of your insight, is how peaceful you're able to become. If you have good insight, you will be able to become peaceful. If you are peaceful, you will have good insight, because these are just two sides of the same coin. These are not different things. They're two sides of the same coin. They go together. And that is, I think, a very important thing, because sometimes I think people tend to divide up vipassana meditation and samatha meditation as if they are two separate things. They're not separate things. They go together. And when you practice one, you get the other. When you practice the other, you get the one. And they move together in the same direction. In the suttas, you find that the words samatha and vipassana are very often a compound. They go together. It's called samatha vipassana, and you contemplate them or you practice them, develop them as a pair, not individually, usually. So then, when we then talk about vipassana or the dhamma nupassana at the end here, contemplation of dhammas, we are talking not just about vipassana, but we're talking about seeing things as they actually are. Yatha bhuta jnana dasana, which is a very specific type of vipassana. It's a very profound type of vipassana where you actually are able to make like the breakthrough to the awakening stages. So this is a very profound aspect of vipassana. And so he then says, he trains thus, I shall breathe in contemplating impermanence. He trains thus, I shall breathe out contemplating impermanence. He trains thus, I shall breathe in contemplating fading away. He trains thus, I shall breathe out contemplating fading away. He trains thus, I shall breathe in contemplating cessation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out contemplating cessation. He trains thus, I shall breathe in contemplating relinquishment. He trains thus, I shall breathe out contemplating relinquishment. So here you are seeing what is it that you are seeing the impermanence of to start off with here? Well, what you are seeing the impermanence of, first and foremost, is all the things that you have let go of through the previous practice. So you are seeing, for example, you're seeing the impermanence of the breath when the breath disappears. You're seeing the impermanence of the hindrances because you see the hindrances disappearing. This is, of course, a very important part of understanding the mind, is to see the impermanence of the hindrances, how they are there and then they disappear, and then how they re-arise again. And when you understand that, you start to understand also how they are abandoned in the future. And of course, at the end, you also understand, and this is where it becomes very profound, you understand things like the impermanence of the five senses, because you abandon these things completely. And beyond that, you also understand the impermanence of the five aggregates altogether. And all of this can be gotten from contemplating that previous experience, and then even going beyond that and contemplating even the impermanence of the deep samadhi itself. And that is where the enlightenment experiences start to happen. So contemplate the impermanence of all things. Impermanence means two things. Impermanence means how things come and go, how they arise, how they diminish, how they increase in strength, etc. So you can see, for example, the hindrances in the mind. Sometimes they're very strong, sometimes they're weak, they come and go. That is one aspect of anicca, of impermanence. But the most important aspect of anicca, the word nicca literally means something which is stable, something which is there, something which is regular. Anicca means like irregular, unstable, something you can't rely on, really. So a more profound understanding of anicca is that it means things disappearing completely. So when the hindrances disappear absolutely completely, that is when you understand their impermanence to the deepest extent. And this is also what is meant by the next step here, the fading away and the cessation of these things, is to understand the fading away and cessation of the hindrances, first of all, and then the fading away and cessation of all these other aspects of this meditation. You see how things fade away, how they disappear, and you understand how beautiful it is when things actually disappear, how profound it is, and what a wonderful thing that is when these things can fade away. And I don't know if some of you may have read Ajahn Brahm's recent book. It's called The Art of Disappearance, or Art of Disappearing, is Ajahn Brahm's latest book. And a large part of that book is basically about how you can fade away, and what a wonderful thing it is to fade away in the world and disappear. That's what the book is about. And this is exactly what's happening here. It's a similar kind of thing. You see the fading away. And what is that fading away? Ultimately, it's you who is fading away. And the more you fade away, the more happy you become. It's a very strange thing here. The more blissed out you become, the more sense of peace you have, the less there is of you, the more happiness there is. And this is one of the things you start to experience and understand as you go through this. And then contemplating the relinquishment. And relinquishment is like the giving up of craving, the giving up of attachment in terms of these things. When you see that the fading away and cessation is beautiful, then why do you crave? Why do you attach to these things anymore? You don't. You give up the attachment. You give up the craving. And that is like relinquishing these things. And that, of course, all of this is you are here on the verge of awakening, of seeing things. You're seeing things as they actually are. And if you continue doing that, then eventually you will have these very, very profound insight experiences of seeing things in the right way according to Buddhism. You will see that there is no self in there. Things are always changing. And all of these things that you experience in the end, they are all a part, an aspect of suffering, of existence. And that's why the more fading away there is, the more cessation there is, the happier you are. So that is the Anapanasati Sutta. Very, very, very profound, this stuff. It starts off, even the beginning is profound. Even the ability to just sit back and being able to be mindful of the breath. For most people, that is already a profound experience. Just being completely still and seeing their breath. That's already very beautiful. And this takes you much, much deeper, way, way beyond that. Very profound stuff, very beautiful things. And as I was mentioning before, when you do this thing here, you are fulfilling the Satipatthanas. Each one of these completes the Satipatthana experiences, the Satipatthana exercises. And when you then complete everything fully, this takes you all the way to the end of the Buddhist path by this sort of practice. So there you are. This is a little bit of deep meditation experience for you. But it's nice sometimes to know where all of this is heading, where all this is going to. So that is the Anapanasati Sutta for you. Does anybody like to ask any questions about the Anapanasati Sutta? Yes. Passive doer, the contemplation really doesn't involve a lot of doing. The contemplation is all, a lot of this thing happens actually as you go along these stages, and then when you sort of come out of the samadhi afterwards, the data is already there. It's already in your mind because you have seen these things happening as you go through it. And then you reflect on it afterwards. There is a little bit of doing there, maybe, but it is not really thinking. It's just like a perception in the mind, and you see that these things happen. And when you then bring it up to the mind afterwards, because the mind is peaceful, it almost happens by itself because it's like you have been pre-programmed in a sense. You know the Dhamma, you know what you have to do. So when you come out of the samadhi, the mind will naturally incline in that direction, and you will reflect on the impermanence and cessation of these things. And then things start to happen. Yeah. So you don't have to do all that much. That's the nice thing here. Yes, Kanchana. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, but remember that the technique in the Vitakka Santana Sutta, the quietening of thought, is about you have still defilements in the mind, right? So this is there a way of overcoming defilement. So in terms of overcoming defilement, it's not a very powerful technique. Yeah? In terms of overcoming defilement, it's quite weak because the defilement often needs something more to be able to go overcome it. But once the defilement is overcome, then the bare awareness comes into its own, and you don't have any willpower anymore. You don't use it anymore. Yeah. Yeah, no, please, yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah. It's any time, basically. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, never mind. Okay, yeah. So, yeah. So the point is that the coarser the state of mind, the more willpower will inevitably be involved in that state of mind. And the more refined the state of mind is, the less willpower is there. Yeah? So as you're getting to this stage here with Anapanasati, the mind is getting very refined. So there's very little willpower left. So that's why bare awareness becomes very powerful at this stage. But with the actual coarse mind, it's a much more difficult thing to do and to use. Yeah. Yes, Steve. Some people say it can be. I'm not convinced because the suttas talk about one type of nimitta. It's the obasa nimitta, the light nimitta. That's what you read. I don't think the suttas say anywhere that there are any alternative ways of experiencing this. So I think the answer is unclear. But I would say that if you have a light nimitta, you can be pretty sure it is the right thing. Yeah. If it is the other things, very often it may be that you're just overestimating yourself. For example, people sometimes talk about the feeling nimitta. But how do you distinguish between a feeling nimitta and just the piti sukha of meditation practice? And this is where it gets tricky. Yeah. So sometimes it can just be a matter of overestimation. Yeah. So I would say if you get a light nimitta, then I think you are more in line with the standard way of practice at the very least. Yeah. Yes?
Something that would happen
It can arise even fairly early on, but it's very unstable at an early stage in the practice. So it will tend to disappear again. So the idea is to here to make a very solid foundation of your practice. That's why you have a stage-by-stage process. And when you get that very solid foundation, then when you get to these even very profound states, and you're better off asking people like Ajahn Brahm than myself, because he really knows these things really, really well. But when you get to this very profound stage of meditation, the nimitta becomes very stable and very good, because you've gone through the whole process of stabilizing it and making it stronger. So it can arise, but sometimes when it arises too early, it's not really worthwhile using it or holding on to it. Just forget about it and make sure the foundation is strong enough, and then you get a really useful nimitta experience later on. Yeah. Yes, Kanchana. Yes, it's about Madhyama 20 is about unwholesome states and how to overcome unwholesome states. Yes, or ideally just about as it is about to arise. So you want to, because once it, if it gets a very strong hold in the mind, it's very hard to get rid of sometimes. Yeah. Yes, Pauline. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Before you asked, I was thinking, how can you do all these things at the same time? You know, is it a bit confusing?
Right,
yeah. The breath is really fading into the background as you come towards the end. It doesn't really matter anymore so much. Exactly. Yeah, it's very helpful. I mean, I remember when I first came to Bodhinyana Monastery here, you know, I've been there for a long time now, but when I first came there, it's Ajahn Brahm who taught me how to read the suttas. So it's very, very useful to have a teacher. And after a while, you become independent and you can read it on your own and you think, okay, now I understand. Now I can argue with the teacher, which is very nice to be able to argue with a teacher, because it means that you are getting your own opinions about things. You have enough confidence that you can understand things on your own. And that's great. So, yeah. Yes.
I'm still doing that. How can that be? Naturally the body will breathe on its own.
Exactly. It is very, very difficult. Yeah. It's true. It's very true. And I agree with you. So it actually is very, very useful to have somebody to give you some guidance. Yeah. Indeed. Yeah. Anybody else want to ask anything about the... Yes, Steve. Yes, usually it is. Because you won't be able to hold an nimitta, you won't be able to sustain it. In fact, you will tend to grasp onto it because it's this is something here powerful and wonderful. You grasp on, and then you lose your whole meditation practice. So just forget about it until it actually. You go through every stage, and it arises strongly and well. That's the time to go for the nimitta experience. Okay. Okay.
One of the things that I think for Westerners perhaps really confuses is that the very first word in the quote, it says, I shall.
Mm.
So it implies this volition. I shall breathe in, contemplate.
Yeah, it's true. It's an interesting way this is phrased, and Yeah. I'm not sure exactly why it is phrased in this way, but I think basically because it is the theme is the breath meditation. The theme is Anapanasati. It uses that theme throughout, and it's important not to sort of hold too tightly to some of these understandings, I think. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You don't want to force it back on the breath again. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to skip the next sutta. The next sutta is actually quite a nice sutta, the Girimananda Sutta, but it takes us a little bit away from the main theme, perhaps. This sutta is about other ways of developing the mind apart from a breathing, a meditation. But I think it is just too much information and too much things to actually go through this one now. So instead, we'll just go through some very simple instructions towards the very end here. And the first one here is the simile of the cloth. This is an extract from the sutta, and this is the standard passage on how to develop the Brahma Viharas, the divine abidings, the metta, the compassion, the mudita, and the equanimity in Buddhism. So this is a standard passage, and this is how the Buddha explained that these things should be developed. And I just wanted to, it's always fascinating to see how the suttas explain these things. So that's why I wanted to go through this. So this is the simile of the cloth, the extract. So this is how the Buddha explained this. He says here, one abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, to all as to oneself. One abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So this is how you do it. But this essentially what this passage is saying. It is saying that somebody who has already developed a very high extent of loving kindness. Because what you're doing is you're pervading each quarter with loving kindness. It basically means that you already have a very powerful and strong perception of loving kindness in your mind to be able to do this. So that is why you often use techniques such as focusing on a particular person or a particular imaginary being or whatever it is. Use these techniques to give rise to the feeling, first of all, to suppress the hindrances. And the actual ideal way, this is really the ideal way of practicing loving kindness and metta, is first to attain deep samadhi. And this is one of the things that you also find in the suttas, is that very often you find that first you attain the jhana states and then you practice loving kindness. Loving kindness is often spoken of after the jhanas. First the four jhanas, the four Brahma Viharas, and then you go beyond. So ideally, you actually do this after you have attained the jhanas. But of course, a large part of the practice is to prepare yourself to practice these things. So a lot of the emphasis is on learning how to refocus the mind, focus on the good things, the good qualities in other people, focusing on compassion, understanding that everybody has suffering in their life. And by refocusing your mind, you're gradually moving towards metta. And this is what, like, the preliminary metta, the sort of metta guided meditation I try to do here is to try to move you in that direction. So slowly enabling you eventually to have the sort of loving kindness that is spoken of in this particular sutta. It's a gradual process and you have to work on it over a long, long period of time. So, and one of the interesting things here you will notice is that it doesn't talk about having metta towards a particular being. It talks about metta towards a direction instead. In other words, it is not anybody specific, it's just all the beings in a particular direction. And again, this is a sort of thing that you have to experiment with yourself in your own meditation, what works for you, what you're able to make work, what gives rise to the good feelings. And whatever gives rise to the good feelings, that is the right way for you to practice the metta. And people find very, very different things. Some people prefer just to start off with the pervasion of the direction straight away without doing any beings in between. Other people find this very hard, and they want to use a being as a guide, as a starting point. So you have to find what functions for you. So you do this then in all directions, and you will notice here it says, to all as to oneself. So you are also included. And of course, this is the nice thing. If you do this to all directions, you're almost like naturally included, because you are also part of this of this geographical space that goes everywhere. You are also part of this. So because of that, you are also automatically included in that. You pervade the all-encompassing world, all beings everywhere, and nobody is excluded. And this is the beauty of this. It's not like, you know, you have metta towards everybody except that one person or that one thing. If you have that, then you are going the wrong way. Everybody is included. No ill will, no sense of anger or anything towards anybody. It becomes very, very, very beautiful. And you transcend this boundary between yourself and others and between certain beings and other beings. And you have a very open, very, very open heart towards everybody. And then it says, you do this, and this again gives you a sense of the power of this thing. It says here, it's abundant, exalted, immeasurable. And these are the these are words that qualify a state which is similar to the very deep states of samadhi, like the jhanas, where things are immeasurable. Appamana. Pamana is a measure. Appamana is without measure. Exalted. I think this may be Mahagata, is it? Or Vipula or something like that. All of these things are things that shows a mind that is very, very lofty and very, very unique and very, very profound experience. So this gives you some idea of how these things are done in the suttas. And this is a very, very high state of samadhi, as I said. And you need to start to practice to get there gradually, gradually, stage by stage. And then the second passage here is about the same thing with the other aspects of the divine abidings, pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion. Compassion is like understanding the suffering and feeling for beings because of the suffering in the world. And don't make it into a sad thing. Just feel that, you know, oh, I wish these people, this wish these beings were free of suffering. That's really all you need to focus on. You don't have to feel sad. Maybe you feel, sometimes it says in the suttas that you tremble for the welfare of other beings. And maybe you can feel a little bit of trembling inside. And that is then you're just following what is natural when you have a compassion for others. And that is also part of the sense of having compassion. And then you do the same thing with appreciative joy, mudita. Mudita basically just means joy. And this is like a gladness of other people's good qualities, of their progress on the path or whatever. You don't feel envious or jealous. You don't have this schadenfreude. You know, you think, you're happy when things go bad for other people. You don't have this sort of things. You feel appreciative of other people's success. Appreciative joy. And the last one is equanimity. Equanimity is when you have this very even mind. This is the point when you go to the samadhi, become so powerful, you go so far in your practice. Basically, this refers to like the fourth jhana state and beyond, that the mind becomes completely even. You have complete equanimity. So what do you... One thing that you are seeing here is that there is a gradual progression also within these Brahma Viharas. These are not just things that you practice, you choose one or the other. There is a gradual progression here. And the reason why metta, loving kindness, is first is because I think it is the most important one and the most basic of these practices. And this is the one I would recommend you to focus on. Equanimity is just so, this is just so profound and so beyond most people to understand what this really means. It is the point where basically you have gone beyond all happy, all pleasurable and unpleasurable feelings. You have come to the point where you understand that a complete neutrality of mind is preferable to any type of happiness, even the most profound. And to understand this is just so difficult, not difficult, but it's so deep, and you have to go so far on the path that it's not really worthwhile trying this kind of practices even. what is really worthwhile is to start off with the first one, the metta, and to have a sense of metta towards beings around you. That is what is really, really worthwhile. And then often with the metta also comes the compassion. It's very difficult sometimes to separate the compassion and the metta absolutely. When you wish other people freedom from suffering, it's really compassion. When you wish them happiness, it's also a kind of compassion. But there's also metta there because you're focusing on the good qualities of people. And that is like the metta. So they're very intertwined and it can be very difficult to separate them. And I wouldn't necessarily try too hard to separate these things. But this is where the focus should be for these things. And then eventually you start moving upwards and higher in these things. So that, I think, is really all I want to say about the simile of the cloth. If you have a chance to do it, sometimes you have teachers who do like metta retreats, and all the focus on is metta meditation. Sometimes it's wonderful to go on those kind of retreats as well. We focus on specific aspects of the Buddhist teachings. We have a few minutes left. There is the simile of the saw just before Majjhima 21. And this is a beautiful simile that the Buddha gave about how you should have metta towards all living beings. And the Buddha says here, monks, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, the one who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. Herein, monks, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no bad words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner anger. We shall abide providing them with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world, with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train yourselves, monks. So this gives you an idea of the power of loving kindness when it's practiced to its maximum. This is what you should expect. And in fact, if you haven't reached this stage yet, you haven't fully practiced the teaching of the Buddha. That's what he's saying here. He's saying that you haven't actually carried out my teaching properly if you haven't reached this stage yet. So this is the kind of promise. And imagine that. Imagine somebody grabbing you, taking you by the limbs and taking out a big saw and starting chopping you up with a two-handled saw or with something. And all you have is loving kindness. I mean, that is it's pretty profound. But it's very beautiful because you have understood something very profound about the Buddha's teachings. These people are acting out of ignorance, out of stupidity. They're making bad karma for themselves. They're just following their own cause and conditions without really knowing what they're doing. So this is based also on very profound insight. Loving kindness is not something which is apart from insight. Even loving kindness and compassion is bound up with insight and understanding. So wisdom and compassion go together. Wisdom and loving kindness go together. They are, again, two aspects of the same thing. They cannot be separated completely, just like samatha and samadhi cannot be separated from insight. So a very beautiful simile there. And then the Buddha, usually after he has given a long teaching, he says, and this is the last sutta on the bottom there, Majjhima 106, this is a very tiny extract of a long sutta. And at the end of the sutta, he says, whatever a teacher should do, seeking the welfare of his disciples, out of sympathy for them, that I have done for you. In other words, I've given you the teachings. This is what I tell you. I have seen this for myself. If you don't believe me, fine. But if you believe me, if you trust me, try it out. Over there are the roots of trees. Over there, empty dwellings. Practice jhana, jayata, ananda. Do not be heedless. Don't later fall into regret. This is our message to you. So in other words, it is up to you, it is up to each one of us to follow the teachings, to practice these things. And of course, don't later fall into regret. That is a very important statement, because what happens is that you You are a Buddhist or you are not a Buddhist, but you practice this beautiful spiritual path, and then you know that there are all these things that you should be doing, you should be practicing, and then you don't do it fully, you don't practice it fully. And then when the end of life comes, you think back, you think, oh, I had the opportunity, I had the chance, I had all the teachings there, I could have done it if I wanted to. I didn't take the opportunity. And then you feel a sense of remorse and regret that you didn't take this wonderful opportunity. And that is what you want to avoid. You want to avoid having that remorse when you are on your deathbed, you're about to pass away. You know that you have done your best, you've practiced it to the best of your ability. So don't have that remorse. Don't have that sadness at the end of your life. And then you will be following the Buddha's teachings to the utmost, doing the right thing. So, any last questions about what we've been saying? Yes, Jake. Yeah. Yeah.
I think there is another sutta in which the Buddha says when a child, for example, throws a pebble in his mouth, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You use a lot of force.
Yeah.
And sometimes lethal force, I believe, as a lay person, is the appropriate action.
Yeah.
I don't know if you agree with that.
But,
it is one thing not to allow hate to arise, and it's another thing to be passive about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the simile here is basically meant when you don't have any choice. You know, it's not as if you have. There's nothing you can do. You know, you are being grabbed by four strong men, and basically you've had it. There's nothing you can do about it. Well, what do you do then in that situation? Well, all you can do is to make sure you don't give rise to anything. But I agree with you. I think it's often good. It's not to be too passive in life because, and this I think is one of the things that Buddhists often get. Criticized for being too passive and that we actually need to be more active with things. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And in any case, I mean, if somebody really wants to, you know, chop you apart, you know, take you to pieces with a two-handled saw, it's not a very good thing to do. So maybe you should say, well, listen, you know, are you sure you want to do this? You know, is this going to be for your benefit? Try to dissuade them from doing something which obviously is very silly here. So I agree. Sometimes even a bit of force might be right, to get you out of that situation. At the very least, if you can run away, I would certainly run away if you have a chance to do that. Okay. Thanks for that. I think that's enough, actually. Yeah. Anything else? Anybody want to raise or to say about this? Everybody happy? Yeah. Maybe next time on the next retreat we can go through things like the Girimananda Sutta and other aspects of the cultivation of mind. If there is a next time, you never know. These things are uncertain. Anicca. So we'll see what happens. Is there anything else you can, if you have any more general questions, anything you want to ask, please ask about anything. Got a few minutes left before we Kanchana, yeah? Yeah. Well, the reason is if you look at what is the opposite of metta, ill will is seeing the negative in somebody. It's the patiga, you have a resistance towards somebody, and metta is the exact opposite of ill will. So it is actually focusing on the good side. So that is what it is, and that it's a very important part. Very important aspect. Without that focusing on the good, you cannot really give rise to metta. Takes a lot of work sometimes to be able to focus on the good in other people. So you really have to try hard, It's one of those things. Yes?
So when the Buddha teaches, so not to believe what he says or what the teacher says, that's more to bring the information into your meditations and then see the validity on it yourself?
Yeah, well, the thing is that it's not wrong to, have a certain faith in what somebody says. I mean, if you read the teachings of the Buddha, they resonate with you and it makes sense. Why shouldn't you have some confidence in that? Why shouldn't you have some faith? But it's also important to understand that faith is not the same as knowledge. Knowledge and deep understanding is one thing. Faith and confidence is something else. So faith is fine. But the thing I think the Buddha was saying was that, well, sometimes you hear all kinds of different messages. Most people in the world are very confused. They hear this, they hear that, they don't know what to believe and what not to believe. And sometimes they throw out the good teachings and take hold of the bad teachings. So very often this kind of message, don't just believe anybody, don't believe me, is often to those people who are very confused, they don't know what to do. And the Buddha says, well, don't believe me, just, you know, this is what I say. You know, good states, wholesome states is a good thing to develop. It's good to avoid the bad states. I say this because I think it works. Try it out and see for yourself. If it works, then place a bit of confidence in me. But confidence in faith is not bad. In fact, it's a good thing. Remember that confidence in faith is one of the spiritual faculties. You have the five spiritual faculties. The first one is confidence. Faith, I don't like the word faith so much because it's too bound up with Christian ideas and maybe other religions. I prefer confidence. You feel a sense that this is right, this is working. It's the first aspect. Without that confidence, normally you don't do anything at all. So even the fact that you are willing to meditate and try it out means that you have some confidence already. If you didn't have that, you wouldn't even be here. You wouldn't bother doing these things. So some confidence is there. Even if you can't see it yourself, it's definitely there already. So don't be afraid of confidence. Don't be afraid of faith. It's good. It's a good quality. But just realize that that's all it is. It is just faith at this stage. It's not knowledge yet. And ideally, I want to transform that faith and confidence into direct understanding of my own, so I can actually see these things for myself. And then it becomes real confidence, because then you have seen it. It's not really confidence anymore, it's like certainty, because you've seen it for yourself. Does that make sense, sir? Yeah? Happy with that? Okay, yeah. Yes, Ananda. Oh, yeah. And I was put on the spot. So after talking about these five aggregates, he asked me.
Yeah.
And the only answer I could give him was that because if it is an entity, must have the control of that entity or the things associated with that entity.
Right.
So this was our plan. He taught me 100%.
You should charge him back. You should have asked for a refund. Yeah, you should have. Okay. Yeah. 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 Well, the main thing about the idea of non-self and the five aggregates is it's true that, you know, you cannot control these things. That's part of the thing. But the idea of the difference between the idea of a soul and the five aggregates is that it is how the soul is defined. You have to understand the definition of these things. And a soul or a permanent entity inside of you is defined as something which is permanent, something which is there all the time, which doesn't change, which is there. The five aggregates, by contrast, are something which is always changing. They always change. They're always transmuting, getting into something else, becoming something else. So a soul, by definition, is something which is permanent, never changes. It's the essence. This is who you really are. You are this entity. This is what you are. So that is the soul. And that is what the Buddha says. Well, we all think we have a soul. We feel that there is an I inside of us. And that feeling has a sense of permanence to it. But actually, that is a wrong perception. It's just a misperception. And it is a perception that you cannot get away from unless you actually penetrate these teachings through insight. So that is what it really means. And what the corollary of that, the kind of extension of that, is because there is no self behind this, there is no permanent entity that is you, there is nothing really that can take charge of things. There's nothing that can say, I want to do things this way or that way. Everything is conditioned. Everything is influenced by external forces. So we are just this, we are this thing which is being conditioned one way, another way, moving this way, moving that way, depending on the things that are working on us. It is only when you have a self that there's something that can withstand the forces around you because it is permanent. It is like a rock. It is solid. It doesn't go anywhere. But when everything is conditioned, then everything is always moving back and forth depending on cause and conditions. Okay, good. Yeah. It is very hard for people to understand. These are very profound things. It's hard to understand because it's counterintuitive. You feel that there is a self inside. Well, I mean, the stream of consciousness again is not a separate thing. Yeah, it's not as if consciousness exists on its own. In fact, consciousness is taking, in a sense, it's taking with it, the karmic potential of the past. So, in a sense, it is taking with it feelings and perceptions and volition. All these things are coming with it to some extent, because there is a continuity in these things, right? Feelings don't just stop and then you become something else in a new life. Perceptions stop and you become something else in a new life. The perception that you have built in this life will tend to continue in the future life. So there is continuity also in perception. There's continuity also in feeling. There's continuity also in volition. So not just a stream of consciousness, it's a stream of all these things coming together. Because consciousness is never by itself. These things come along with consciousness. So it is much broader. The physical body obviously doesn't go with you. That is pretty clear. But the rest of it goes with you from one life to the next as a stream. Just 1 second, Donna. Just Prem first of all. Yeah. Yeah. There is actually quite a lot of suttas given to lay disciples and given to kings, and there are suttas given to nuns, to female male disciples. All kind of things are in there. So there is there are suttas about meditation even to lay people, yes. But the teachings to lay people in the suttas tend to be fairly simple. They tend to be fairly kind of, be moral, be generous, live a good life. Occasionally there are suttas to the lay people about meditation. There's one famous sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha speaks to Anattapindika. Anattapindika was the most generous donor towards the Sangha in those days. And he says to Anattapindika, well, even you lay people, sometimes it's good for you to step aside from ordinary life, find some seclusion, and feel the happiness which comes, which is apart from sensuality. So there Buddha is saying specifically in one sutta that lay people too should do meditation practice and should step aside from ordinary activities. But it is true that today the suttas are available in a way that they weren't available in those days to the same extent to everybody. And the Buddha sometimes says that, the question often is, how much knowledge, how much learning do you need to practice the Dhamma? And sometimes there are places in the suttas where the Buddha, somebody goes to Buddha and says, somebody of great learning, what does this mean, blessed one? And the Buddha replies, somebody of great learning, it means that if you have a four-line verse with four lines and you understand that four-line verse fully, then you are a person of great learning. So depth is more important than width. And sometimes when people read too much and they become too involved in kind of study and these kind of things, it can take away from the depth. It can take away from the depth. I have to sometimes be careful with that myself, because I certainly enjoy reading the suttas. But so you have to, the depth is actually what really matters. The width is not so important, as long as you get the depth of these things. Okay. I am a little bit afraid of going too much over time. I have a note here from Bianca that she would like to have a meeting with people at 9:30. How are things going? Do you know, Dana, what's happening? Yeah? Yeah? Bianca isn't here, is she? Yeah. No. Cleaning up, okay. Okay. So can we go a little bit longer? Okay. Do people want to go a little bit longer? A few more questions? Yeah? Okay. Yes, Donna.
Just what you said a while ago about the stream of consciousness and the karmic load sort of attached to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because this is all that consciousness, stream of consciousness, and the karmic baggage that one carries is identified with that person right through. So that to me contradicts slightly the theory of anatta, which says there's nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it is difficult to understand, and that is why many people will say exactly what you are saying. They're saying, well, you know, if you have rebirth, then surely there must be a self. But the point is that there isn't any self. You know, if there is no self, there is no self right here, right now. And yet, if you think of your life right here, right now, you see continuity. You see Don Veracodi, you know, being a young boy, growing up, going to university or whatever, and working and doing all these things. And you see the continuity, and yet, when you look at yourself very carefully, there's nothing in there which is permanent. There's nothing in there which carries through all the way along. Sometimes it feels like that. It feels like there's something inside you which carries through all the way along. But if you look at it very closely, you will see it's all just discrete moments of consciousness arising and passing away, and there's nothing there. And it is exactly the same process that is happening in this life that happens from one life to the next one. There's no difference. It is exactly the same thing. So if you can see that in this life there is not even a self, then much less is there any self across lives. It's exactly the same principle working there. I think that's a good way of looking at it, because if you understand that principle in this life, then it's not so hard to extrapolate also into future lives and past lives. Tanya. Okay. Okay, yeah. Okay, I think what he's saying there is that consciousness is like different depending on the kind of object you have. So there is like nose consciousness, there is the tongue consciousness, there's mind consciousness. And in a sense, these are all discrete, different consciousnesses. And because they are different, it's like each one forms a kind of stream on its own right, perhaps. That's probably maybe what he's referring to there. Anyway, very profound things there. So, anything else anybody wants to ask before we call it an end? Yes. Yeah, no. Yeah. Well, they are the same thing, basically. You know, the idea of impermanence, the idea of non-self, is the same thing here. It is precisely because it is impermanent, it is a non-self. So they go together, and the same thing with suffering. Suffering also is the same. Basically, there are different aspects of looking at the same thing here. There are five aggregates. They are impermanent. They are suffering. You can't control them, and there is no self. And it's the same kind of thing. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. 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 Well, the idea it is really both, you see, and the idea is that the psychology of this life is equivalent to like states of rebirth in a future life. So there is a parallel there. So and that is why, in a sense, you are creating your future life. You're creating that here and now. And whatever state of rebirth you can have in the future can be experienced right here and right now as a very terrible mental state or a very blissful mental state. So psychology in this life and rebirth in a future life, there is an equivalence between the two. The equivalence between what some people have said microcosm and macrocosm. The microcosm is your experience in this life. The macrocosm is like the bigger picture of things, including rebirth. So yes, there is an equivalence there. But what some people do, they say that the idea of rebirth is redundant because all of these things just concern experiences in this life. It doesn't concern rebirth. But that is, as far as I'm concerned, a very, very wrong idea of what the Buddha taught. The Buddha made it very clear that rebirth, there is such a thing as rebirth. And not only is there rebirth, but rebirth is actually the problem. That is the real issue that we're dealing with as practitioners on this path. This is what the problem is. Because you keep on going on and on and on and on forever, doing stupid things, sometimes having tremendous suffering, sometimes experience happiness. And after a while, you think, I've had enough of this. I don't want to keep going on like this forever. It doesn't make any sense. It's completely pointless. Not only is it pointless, it's suffering on top of being pointless. So double pointless, if you like. So it is very, very important part of the Buddhist teachings, the idea of rebirth. Take it out. You don't have Buddhism anymore, as far as I'm concerned. But at the same time, there is some truth to what you're saying. Yes. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's very hard to explain the no self entity.
Yeah.
Through the effort of putting in, doing all the good and not doing bad.
Yeah.
Create good karma. Yeah. We go, you know.
Yeah.
The only difference is rebirth. We don't know where we're going to rebirth into, whether, you know, physical form or human form.
Yeah.
The concept of no entity, no one, at the same time, you have to build up something to carry forward consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the thing is that, you know, even though there is no self, there is no permanent entity inside, there's still a sense of you as an independent person. And that sense of you as an independent person is precisely the stream of consciousness which carries on according to karma. And this is a feeling you have. And the most important aspect of this is you don't want to, why would you want to hurt yourself? Why would you want to hurt this being, which is this stream of consciousness? It doesn't matter whether there's a self there or not. There is this experience of pain, and that is enough. If you experience pain, whether that is related to a self or not a self, is completely irrelevant. You don't want to have pain. So because you don't want pain, you make sure that in this life you live in such a way that you don't have too much pain. Because you know that you're going to live in a future life, you make sure that you have maximum happiness also in the future life. Yeah.
And yet we tell people there's no self. You know, it's a bit hard to carry the idea across.
Well, it's just like in this life. You don't want to experience pain in this life. There's no self here and now. It doesn't matter whether there's a self here and now. You're still experiencing pain. So forget about that. Just you don't want to have pain. So you don't want to have pain in the next life either. You don't do it. Don't. Yeah. Yeah. It is a very profound teaching. It is very profound, and that is why it's hard to understand. So sometimes when Buddhists talk about non-self, well, remember that this is the teaching the Buddha gave. You don't even know if it's true. Maybe it's wrong. Yeah, maybe there is a self. The point is that you have certain faith that, okay, there probably is no self. Well, let me try to find this out for myself. No, let me try to find this out, whether there is a self or not. And then you... And then that is when you really know whether it's a self or not. But so far, you don't actually know that. It's just a faith, just a confidence. So make sure that at the very least, you get some happiness out of this life, you know, that you have enjoy yourself, you don't make it too hard. Make good karma. If you think there is a rebirth, make sure you have a good rebirth, for heaven's sake. Don't have a bad one. That's just being silly to have a bad rebirth. You know, being a bodhisattva, trying to be a bodhisattva is very dangerous because then you might get reborn in a bad destination. So anyway, I think it's probably time to stop. So let's just do the homage to the triple gem again, and let's just do the arahang as we finish off the retreat.